Penguin Random House Audio presents Fossil Future: Why Global Human Flourishing Requires More Oil, Coal, and Natural Gas, Not Less. This is the author, Alex Epstein. To readers of The Moral Case for Fossil Fuels. Note, if you've never read my previous book on fossil fuels, I encourage you to skip this section and go straight to Chapter 1. In my 2014 book, The Moral Case for Fossil Fuels, I made the highly unusual and controversial prediction that fossil fuel use would grow, not shrink, and that the benefits of growing fossil fuel use to human flourishing would far outweigh its negative side effects, including any negative climate impacts. My prediction was based on three conclusions. 1. Fossil fuels had and would continue to have a unique ability to provide low-cost, reliable energy in a world where far more energy would be needed going forward, especially for the billions of people who still used almost no energy. 2. Low-cost, reliable energy, by empowering us to use machines to improve our lives, has fundamental, radically underappreciated benefits, including the benefit of transforming our environment into one that is unnaturally clean and unnaturally safe from climate danger. 3. While the rising CO2 levels that came with growing use of low-cost, reliable fossil fuel energy would have a warming impact on the global climate system, that impact would not be catastrophic, but rather continue to be masterable by ingenious human beings empowered by fossil-fueled machines, irrigation machines that counter drought, heating and air conditioning machines that counter harmful temperatures, and so on. If you read The Moral Case for Fossil Fuels and are listening to this book, it's likely that you found my conclusions at least somewhat convincing. But even if you found them very convincing, it is understandable that you might think I have been proved substantially wrong, given what is reported to us on a daily basis, that fossil fuels no longer have any unique benefits, and that fossil-fueled climate change has been causing immense harm that we can no longer adapt to, let alone master. Today, stories about how renewables, specifically solar and wind, are rapidly replacing fossil fuels due to superior economics are ubiquitous. Some of our most impressive technology companies, such as Apple, Google, and Facebook, proclaim themselves to be 100% renewable, with the implication that if 100% renewable is working for them, then it can surely work for the rest of us. Also on a daily basis, we see stories about how fossil-fueled climate change is now an existential threat to our lives. New alleged catastrophe predictions have become prominent, such as ocean acidification and mass species extinction. And climate-related disasters such as storms, floods, and wildfires are presented as reaching new and overwhelming heights of danger. Witness the horrific, out-of-control wildfires in California and Australia, which we are told are without precedent and are unmanageable by any means other than by rapidly eliminating our CO2 emissions. In sum, today's incessant narrative is that fossil fuels are making the world a worse and worse place to live, but renewables are coming to the rescue, and could do far more if we would just get off fossil fuels already. If true, this narrative would certainly refute my predictions and my call in The Moral Case for Fossil Fuels to use more fossil fuel energy going forward, not less. But, as I stressed in Moral Case, to know the truth, we cannot just look at anecdotes or narratives. We have to look at the big picture facts. And if we look at the big picture facts about fossil fuels, alternatives, human flourishing, and climate, the moral case for fossil fuels has thus far been completely vindicated. Fact 1. Fossil fuels are still the dominant source of energy around the world, providing 4 times more energy than all alternatives combined. And fossil fuel use is still growing. Renewable, solar, and wind are just 3% of the world's energy, a 3% that is dependent on mandates, subsidies, and reliable fossil fuel power plants, a 3% that is leading to increasing costs and or major reliability problems everywhere solar and wind are used in non-trivial quantities. Fact 2. The world has continued to become a better place to live especially for the poorest people, and low-cost, reliable energy from fossil fuels is a fundamental cause. Among many other benefits, fossil fuels have powered the increased industrialization that has brought down the rate of extreme poverty. The percentage of people living on less than $2 a day, from 42% in 1980 to less than 10% today. Fact 3. While fossil fuels have contributed to a warming global climate system, that warming amounts to 1 degree Celsius over the last 170 years. And climate-related disaster deaths continue to fall to all-time lows, thanks in large part to fossil-fueled climate mastery. From fossil-fueled irrigation, to fossil-fueled heating and cooling, to fossil-fueled construction of sturdy buildings, to fossil-fueled early warning systems. Over the last century, the rate of climate-related disaster deaths has fallen by 98%. While you may be heartened, as I have been, by the vindication of the moral case for fossil fuels so far, you may still wonder if, going forward, the facts on the ground might change drastically as more and more money and talent go into renewables and as the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere rises. I, too, have wondered this. Over the last 7 years, I've become particularly interested in understanding and evaluating the long-term future of fossil fuels. What can we expect to be the benefits and side effects of fossil fuels compared with the alternatives in the decades and generations to come? Seeking to answer this question has led me to spend a lot more time researching and thinking about energy, human flourishing, and climate. It has also led me to develop a much more explicit framework for thinking about energy issues than I had when I wrote The Moral Case for Fossil Fuels. I call this framework the Human Flourishing Framework. Also helpful has been discussing these issues with tens of thousands of people as I've traveled the United States and the world sharing my ideas. When I began thinking more about the long-term future of fossil fuels, I have to admit that I expected to become a little bit less enthusiastic about them. There was a period of a couple years after The Moral Case for Fossil Fuels when I didn't follow technical developments in energy and in climate as closely as I had before or have since. Popular reporting was so emphatic about the radical improvement of renewables and unprecedented negative developments in climate that I thought, maybe promoting fossil fuels isn't what I want to spend my time on. But once I started an intensive study of the long-term future of fossil fuels, armed with a much better framework and the latest facts, I became convinced that there is a far stronger moral case to be made for fossil fuels than I thought. A case that extends generations. A moral case for a fossil future. Unfortunately, while the reality of fossil fuels has become much more positive, and my understanding has become much more positive, fossil fuel policy and perception have gone in exactly the opposite direction. Whereas in 2014, the policy of rapid elimination of fossil fuels was a rather extreme position, now it is almost ubiquitously viewed as the mainstream expert view, with institutions from every part of the culture declaring their support for fossil fuel elimination by pledging to be net zero or carbon neutral by 2050 at the latest. Surveys about fossil fuels and climate show that some 50% of the people in many countries believe that fossil-fueled climate change threatens to cause the extinction of the human race. Climate emergency and climate crisis are no longer treated as predictions about the future. They are treated as descriptions of the present, even though in the present we are safer from climate than any human population has ever been. Given that I regard continuing expanding fossil fuel use as essential to global human flourishing, I regard net zero proposals as apocalyptically as others regard fossil-fueled climate change. Net zero policy, if actually implemented, would certainly be the most significant act of mass murder since the killings of 100 million people by communist regimes in the 20th century, and it would likely be far greater. If you don't believe me, I think you will once you listen to chapters 4-6 of this book. Because net zero policies are so apocalyptic, I believe they will never be implemented consistently. In particular, China, Russia, and India have given every indication that they will not adopt such policies. But the increasingly consistent attempts to implement fossil fuel elimination policies will certainly have two consequences that I want to do whatever I can to avert. One consequence is the indefinite delay of the world's poorest places bringing themselves out of poverty, which today requires fossil fuels. It's always easier to stop something new than to stop something in progress. Thus, the anti-fossil fuel movement has and will continue to find it easier to stop new fossil fuel development throughout Africa than it has in slowing existing fossil fuel development in China or India. The second consequence to avert is economic suicide by the world's freest countries, including my own country, the United States of America. Right now, the countries most avidly embracing fossil fuel elimination in their plans are the traditionally freest countries. Contrast this with unfree China, which has an explicit goal of being the world's leading superpower by 2049 and is using an 85% fossil fuel economy to get there, including by using fossil fuels to produce unreliable solar panels and wind turbines that are contributing to the higher prices and lower reliability of the U.S. electrical system, which in turn is becoming less and less attractive to industry. The unprecedented security that America, and largely by extension the rest of the free world, enjoys today is due to America's economic strength and its military might. Both depend on low-cost, reliable energy. As Daniel Yergin documented in The Prize, war requires mobility, and wars are often won by those with the best mobile energy, above all, oil. A world in which free countries are killing their economies and, by extension, their militaries, while China leverages low-cost, reliable fossil fuel energy to become the largest economy with the most formidable military, is not a world I want to live in. For these reasons and many others that will emerge in this book, I regard the drastic decline in fossil fuel policy and perception as an existential threat to freedom and flourishing around the world, including a threat to the long-term existence of the United States. It has been upsetting to witness this trend occurring, despite my and others' efforts to persuade people about the moral case for fossil fuels, and despite the fact that we have been proven right. However, I have also been heartened by the impact that the moral case for fossil fuels has had, along with my work promoting its ideas in many different forms and forums. Time after time, I've seen my arguments turn non-supporters into supporters, including those from unlikely backgrounds, such as liberal Harvard students and former climate activists. Just as important, I've seen my arguments turn supporters into champions, people who themselves can win over others. In 2014, I called on the fossil fuel industry to stand up for itself. It's not happening as much as is necessary, but now there are prominent CEOs, including Chris Wright of Liberty Oilfield Services and Adam Anderson of Innovex, making the moral case for their industry. In 2014, I called on people in poorer places to champion fossil fuel energy. Now, individuals including energy researcher Vijay Jayaraj in India and African Energy Chamber's NJ Ayak are doing just that. The success of my work in turning non-supporters into supporters and supporters into champions, combined with the drastic decline in public opinion of fossil fuels, has motivated me to improve my ability to explain the facts about energy and to think a lot about the highest leverage ways I can spread the truth. In 2018, I concluded that the best thing I could do would be to write an entirely new book about fossil fuels, one that is completely current, far more comprehensive, far clearer, and far more future-oriented than The Moral Case for Fossil Fuels. My goal in Fossil Future is to help far more people learn the truth, both directly, through the book, and indirectly by helping other supporters of fossil fuels and energy freedom, hopefully you, explain the evidence to others clearly and persuasively. I hope you find Fossil Future enjoyable, clarifying, and empowering. Part 1. Framework. Chapter 1. Ignoring Benefits. Save the World With fossil fuels? In this book, I'm going to try to persuade you of something that may seem crazy to you, something that definitely used to seem crazy to me. I'm going to try to persuade you that if you want to make the world a better place, one of the best things you can do is fight for more fossil fuel use, more burning of oil, coal, and natural gas. While we are almost universally told that more fossil fuel use will destroy the world, I am going to make the case that more fossil fuel use will actually make the world a far better place. A place where billions more people will have the opportunity to flourish, including to pull themselves out of poverty, to have a chance to pursue their dreams, and, this will likely seem craziest of all, to experience higher environmental quality and less danger from climate. I am not going to make the case for more fossil fuel use by making some climate change denier argument that fossil fuel CO2 emissions aren't impacting climate. I totally acknowledge that they have contributed to the 1 degree Celsius warming we've experienced over the last 100 plus years, and they will contribute to further warming going forward. But I will argue that the negative climate impacts of fossil fuels will be far, far outweighed by the unique benefits of fossil fuels. Fossil fuels, which provide 80% of the world's energy, have and will continue to have the unique benefit of providing low-cost, reliable energy to billions of people in thousands of places, a benefit that is desperately needed in a world where some 3 billion people still use less electricity than a typical American refrigerator. Contrary to claims that solar and wind are rapidly replacing fossil fuels, fossil fuel use is still growing, while intermittent solar and wind energy, after generations on the market, provide just 3% of the world's energy. And that 3% is totally dependent on fossil fuels, especially natural gas, for 24/7 backup. Solar and wind are nowhere near being able to replace the energy that fossil fuels provide today, let alone the far greater amounts of energy humanity needs going forward. One of the key benefits of more fossil fuel use, I will argue, will be powering our enormous and growing ability to master climate danger, whether natural or man-made, an ability that has made the average person on Earth 50 times less likely to die from a climate-related disaster than they were in the 1 degree Celsius colder world of 100 years ago. Because fossil fuel use is so vital to the world's future, I will argue, today's proposed policies to rapidly eliminate fossil fuel use would, if fully implemented, have truly apocalyptic consequences, making the world an impoverished, dangerous, and miserable place for most people. And even if fossil fuel elimination policies aren't fully implemented, which they won't be, given the expressed intent of China, Russia, and India to increase their fossil fuel use, even widespread restrictions on fossil fuel use that fall far short of elimination will shorten and inflict misery on billions of lives, especially in the poorest parts of the world. Obviously, you wouldn't want to participate in the movement to rapidly eliminate fossil fuel use if it actually meant inflicting these kinds of harms on other people. And you would want to fight for more fossil fuel use if it actually made the world a far better place. But is there really any chance that I'm right? Questioning the expert moral case for eliminating fossil fuels. The idea that more fossil fuel use is something profoundly beneficial that you should fight for, and that eliminating fossil fuel use is something profoundly destructive that you should fight against, totally contradicts what trusted source after trusted source tells us, that experts, especially climate scientists, have reached a near unanimous consensus that fossil fuel use needs to be rapidly eliminated. The argument we hear for this conclusion, which I call the moral case for eliminating fossil fuels, usually goes something like this. CO2 emissions from the world's massive use of fossil fuels are causing catastrophic climate change, including ever worse heat waves, storms, floods, wildfires, and droughts. Catastrophic climate change, along with other negative side effects of fossil fuel use, such as air pollution and water pollution, make us morally obligated to rapidly eliminate fossil fuel use and reach net zero CO2 emissions by 2050 at the latest, so as to limit warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius, or at the absolute most, 2 degrees Celsius over pre-industrial, pre-fossil fuel temperatures. What will replace fossil fuels? Green renewable energy, especially solar and wind energy, which are already rapidly replacing fossil fuels at lower cost and with sufficient political will, can soon power the world. The only people who oppose the rapid elimination of fossil fuels and its replacement by green energy are deniers and delayers. Above all, the fossil fuel industry, who are placing their short-term convenience and profits above people and the planet. This moral case for eliminating fossil fuels is not portrayed as one competing view among many. It is portrayed as the near-unanimous consensus of experts by a wide variety of trusted sources, including leading news institutions such as the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the BBC, the spokespeople of numerous public scientific institutions, above all, the prestigious United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, the spokespeople of every major government around the world, all of whom have signed on to the Paris Climate Agreement, which calls for the rapid elimination of fossil fuel use to prevent climate catastrophe, and the leaders of leading financial institutions, such as BlackRock, and corporations, such as Apple, who have signed on to net zero or 100% renewable pledges, claiming that they are moral and practical. When so many trusted sources are telling us there is an expert consensus for fossil fuel elimination, it may be hard to imagine the moral case for eliminating fossil fuels isn't at least basically right. Sure, maybe people don't know the exact magnitude of climate catastrophe that we face, or exactly the best way to replace fossil fuels with renewables, but there's no way the experts could be totally wrong, as this Alex Epstein guy is arguing. So it may feel safe to oppose fossil fuels, and certainly there's no need to go out on a limb and fight against fossil fuel elimination. However, there are two factors that I urge you to consider before you stop listening to this book. The first factor is that although we should certainly take it seriously when so many trusted sources tell us that something is the expert view, we know that throughout history, what the general public is told the experts think has sometimes proved to be very wrong. In fact, some of history's greatest evils, racism, slavery, eugenics, have been justified as supported by the experts. The second factor is that the allegedly expert policy of rapidly eliminating fossil fuel use involves an incredibly radical and potentially disastrous change in how we use energy. We are being told that we must do away with fossil fuels, the source of 80% of the world's energy, in a world where billions of people desperately lack energy. And we are being told that intermittent solar and wind, which provide just 3% of the world's energy after many decades on the market, and which today depend on fossil fuels for 24/7 backup, will definitely be able to replace the 80% of energy we get from fossil fuels, plus provide most of the additional energy the world needs in less than 30 years. If these radical changes do not work out, billions of people will have no chance at having affordable, reliable energy. Let me make this concrete by sharing a story that I think about a lot, because it captures what it means to lack affordable, reliable energy. The story is told by a visitor to the Gambia, one of many African countries that desperately lacks energy. June 2006. At 4 p.m. on a Saturday afternoon, I was startled when the lights came on. The lights never came on after 2 p.m. on the weekends. The adrenaline really kicked in when I was invited to observe an emergency cesarean section. A first for me. When the infant emerged, I felt my heart racing from excitement and awe. But no matter how many times the technician suctioned out the nose and mouth, the infant did not utter a sound. After 25 minutes, the technician and nurse both gave up. The surgeon later explained that the baby had suffocated in utero. If only they had had enough power to use the ultrasound machine for each pregnancy, he would have detected the problem earlier and been able to plan the C-section. Without early detection, the C-section became an emergency. Moreover, the surgery had to wait for the generator to be powered on. The loss of precious minutes meant the loss of a precious life. At that time, in that place, all I could do was cry. And later, when the maternity ward too was hushed, I cried again. A full-term infant was born weighing only 3.5 pounds. In the U.S., the solution would have been obvious and effective: incubation. But without reliable electricity, the hospital did not even contemplate owning an incubator. This seemingly simple solution was not available to this newborn girl, and she perished needlessly. Reliable electricity is at the forefront of every staff member's thoughts. With it, they can conduct tests with electrically powered medical equipment, use vaccines and antibiotics requiring refrigeration, and plan surgeries to meet patients' needs. Without it, they will continue to give their patients the best care available, but in a country with an average life expectancy of only 54 years of age, it's a hard fight to win. The tragedy of babies dying for lack of the energy needed to power ultrasound machines and incubators occurs every day in the many parts of the world without affordable, reliable energy. Thankfully, it is a tragedy that happens far less frequently than it used to, because billions of people in developing countries like China and India have used fossil fuels to provide affordable, reliable energy. If we join the movement to rapidly eliminate fossil fuels, and it turns out that intermittent solar and wind cannot replace fossil fuels, both for the billions who have affordable, reliable energy and the billions who need it, we will absolutely have blood on our hands. When the stakes are this high, it is not enough to just go by what we are told the experts say. We need to think critically, ask questions, and consider dissenting arguments. I hope you'll give me the opportunity to explain how I, someone who began as a philosopher with no connection to the fossil fuel industry, came to question and ultimately totally disagree with the supposedly expert moral case for eliminating fossil fuels. How to know when the experts are wrong. When we hear that a person is totally contradicting what we're told the experts think, it's easy to assume that person will be dismissive of expertise. So let me be clear from the outset. That's not me. I absolutely recognize that in a modern specialized society, we need to rely on experts, specialists, to help us evaluate what to do about crucial issues in their area of expertise, from how to fix a leak in our homes, to how to treat COVID-19, to what diet to adopt, to what to do about fossil fuels. But I also recognize that what we're told the experts think can be very, very wrong. As a philosopher who has studied the history of ideas extensively, I have long been haunted by the fact that some of the worst ideas in history, such as slavery, racism, and eugenics, were successfully spread as the consensus of the experts. This fact has motivated me to think extensively about the questions: how do I rely on experts responsibly? How do I gain the crucial benefit of acting on expert knowledge while avoiding becoming one of the many people throughout history who support something very wrong because they were told the experts endorsed it? You might think that answering such questions is impossible because we would need to know, as outsiders to fields such as nutrition, virology, climate science, and energy, when experts who have been researching those fields for decades are making mistakes in their research. Happily, this turns out not to be the case, because most of the time when what we're told the experts think turns out to be very wrong, it is not because most of the actual expert researchers in a field are very wrong about their field. It is because the system we rely on to tell us what experts think is significantly distorting what actual experts think. And if we know how this distortion works, we can often spot it at work and protect ourselves against it. Whenever we hear about what the experts think, we need to keep in mind that most of us have no direct access to what most expert researchers in a field think. We are being told what experts think through a system of institutions and people that performs four crucial functions. 1. Engage in expert research about the world. 2. Synthesize the essentials from expert research. 3. Disseminate essential expert knowledge to the rest of us. And 4. Help us evaluate what actions to take on the basis of expert knowledge. Understanding how this system, which I call our knowledge system, works and how it can go wrong is the key to being able to spot when what we're told the experts think is very wrong about fossil fuels or anything else. How research works. The foundation of any knowledge system is its researchers, people or institutions that engage in highly specialized research about different aspects of the world. On the issue of fossil fuels, for example, there are energy researchers who study the physics of energy production, the technology of energy production, the economics of energy production, etc. Climate researchers who study the physics of climate, the greenhouse effect of CO2, climate history, etc. And environmental quality researchers who study air quality, water quality, the effects of pollution on the human body, etc. Leading research institutions in our knowledge system include universities, Harvard, Yale, Stanford, government research institutions, NOAA, NASA, NSF, and specialized journals within a field, Nature Climate Change, Geophysical Research Letters, Climate Dynamics. Note, when I refer to our knowledge system, I am referring to the mainstream knowledge system, the institutions and people that overwhelmingly influence the ideas and policies of today, including our ideas and policies regarding fossil fuels. I will discuss alternatives to the mainstream knowledge system, including both their potential pitfalls and potential advantages, later in this book. One key fact to understand about research, which can help us spot when the work of researchers is being distorted by the rest of our knowledge system, is that new research is challenging, error-prone work. This is reflected by the fact that in the frontiers of research, such as exploring causes of and treatments for cancer, there is significant uncertainty and disagreement. Knowing the uncertain and contentious nature of new research enables us to spot a very common distortion of research: cherry-picking the controversial new conclusion of some researchers and portraying it as the view of all expert researchers. Take the common occurrence of a confident new claim that scientists have found some new major cause of cancer, leaving the impression that all qualified scientists are on board. Given the actual difficulties and uncertainties involved with the frontiers of research, it is nearly impossible that such a new conclusion will immediately become the settled view of virtually all expert researchers. One sign that the moral case for eliminating fossil fuels involves cherry-picking research is that it portrays, as a matter of settled science, the extremely specific prediction that an increase of 2 degrees Celsius in the average global temperature compared with pre-industrial levels will definitely mean global catastrophe. But in any complex field, predictions of the future are at the frontier of the field and the source of huge uncertainty and disagreement. Because of the way research works, it is virtually impossible that all researchers have the portrayed level of confidence and agreement on the 2 degrees Celsius number. And if you look into this issue, you will indeed find a huge range of conclusions among researchers about which level of warming leads to what consequences, including the conclusion of the world's leading climate economist, Nobel Prize winner William Nordhaus, that 2 degrees Celsius is not catastrophic and that passing policies to prevent it would do far more harm than good. But you would never know this from the mainstream knowledge system's portrayal of the experts, because the mainstream knowledge system's synthesizers, disseminators, and evaluators are not doing their jobs properly. How synthesis can go wrong. The vital work of researchers in any field generates a near limitless amount of specialized knowledge, to the point that no one in any modern field can know close to everything even about their own field. For example, while it is common to talk about climate scientists as a uniform group, most climate scientists are actually specialists in a particular aspect of climate science, such as paleoclimatology, the use of ancient evidence to deduce what ancient climates were like, climate physics, oceanography, or climate modeling, and tend to know the research and their subspecialty very well, while not knowing anywhere near as much about the other aspects of climate science. If the near limitless amount of specialized knowledge acquired by researchers is to be made useful to as many people as possible, it needs to be synthesized, organized, refined, and condensed. In climate science, the world's leading synthesizer is the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, which synthesizes research that is performed mostly in universities and in government science institutions. Other climate-related synthesizers include the U.S. government's National Climate Assessment and various scientific professional organizations such as the American Meteorological Society. In energy, leading synthesizers include the International Energy Agency, the U.S. Energy Information Administration, and BP, a private company whose syntheses are widely respected as nonpartisan. One way that synthesis can go wrong is through honest error, stemming from the inherent difficulty of synthesis. It takes incredible diligence and judgment to take the research of an entire field and synthesize it in an accurate way. Synthesizers can make major mistakes with even the best of intentions, such as honestly getting wrong in the field of nutrition, which group of researchers has the best understanding of the relationship between food and heart disease. Another, and far more destructive way in which synthesis can go wrong, is via the manipulation of synthesizing bodies. Because synthesizers, whether the U.S. Department of Agriculture, USDA, in nutrition, or the IPCC in climate science are so influential, they are major targets for companies, activist organizations, and power-seeking politicians who want to change policy in their favor. For example, in nutrition, lobbies from different food industries invariably take an interest in who is leading synthesis efforts, because that can radically shift what the public is told the experts think, from the view that milk is essential to the view that milk is bad, from the view that grain is the number one component of nutrition to the view that grain is bad, from the view that beef is essential to the view that beef is bad, and so on. In the realm of fossil fuels, the decision of who is chosen to lead the UN IPCC assessment reports necessarily has huge consequences for what is included in and excluded from those reports. And the various powers that influence the International Energy Agency have huge influence on what it predicts and recommends with regard to the future of energy. One way to spot when syntheses are going wrong is to look for crucial variables or facts that are being omitted from a synthesis. For example, we can look at whether a synthesis of nutrition endorsing one specific diet, whether vegan or ketogenic, is ignoring the existence of healthy populations who don't follow the endorsed diet. If we look for variables omitted by the IPCC, the central body invoked by the moral case for eliminating fossil fuels, we find a major one: the death rate from climate-related disasters over time. The death rate from climate-related disasters, especially over the last 100-plus years, as CO2 levels have risen, tells us an enormous amount about humans' ability to adapt to or master climate danger, which will tell us a lot about which potential climate changes would and wouldn't be serious problems. And yet, if you go through the multi-thousand-page IPCC synthesis reports, you will not find any quantification of climate-related disaster deaths. And if you review the world's leading source of climate disaster data, you will find that it totally contradicts the moral case for eliminating fossil fuels. Climate-related disaster deaths have plummeted by 98% over the last century, as CO2 levels have risen from 280 parts per million to 420 parts per million, and temperatures have risen by 1 degree Celsius. Whatever the IPCC's motives for omitting the fact of plummeting climate-related disaster deaths, one thing is certain: when the world's most influential synthesizing institution does not include a crucial variable, what we are told the experts think is inevitably and significantly distorted. How dissemination can go wrong. Once synthesizers do their job, however well or poorly, the essentials of their syntheses need to be disseminated. Disseminators are the institutions and people that disseminate the essentials of synthesized research to the general public and decision makers, including policymakers. Although there are many different disseminators in the world, including all kinds of alternative media, in this book I am going to focus on the mainstream disseminators, as they are the ones leading the movement to eliminate fossil fuels. By the same token, I am going to focus on the mainstream knowledge system of research and synthesis. Mainstream disseminators include leading news institutions, such as the New York Times and the Washington Post, the mainstream educational system, from elementary school to graduate school, and spokespeople for various scientific organizations, such as the IPCC, the American Meteorological Society, and the National Academy of Sciences. The dissemination of synthesized research is frequently distorted to a degree that is almost impossible to overestimate. The author Michael Crichton memorably captured the potential for horrifically bad distortion by disseminators when he coined the term the Gell-Mann amnesia effect, which he discussed with the famous physicist Marie Gell-Mann. Briefly stated, the Gell-Mann amnesia effect is as follows. You open the newspaper to an article on some subject you know well. In Murray's case, physics. In mine, show business. You read the article and see the journalist has absolutely no understanding of either the facts or the issues. Often the article is so wrong, it actually presents the story backward, reversing cause and effect. You read with exasperation or amusement the multiple errors in a story, and then turn the page to national or international affairs and read as if the rest of the newspaper was somehow more accurate about Palestine than the baloney you just read. You turn the page and forget what you know. One way to catch major distortions of synthesized research by disseminators is to review, even briefly, the synthesis that they are claiming to report on. If you do this with the actual IPCC synthesis reports, you will likely be shocked by how badly they are distorted by mainstream disseminators, including the IPCC's own disseminator document, the Summary for Policymakers. The distortions involved in these summaries have been repeatedly documented by researchers who have resigned from IPCC dissemination bodies, such as leading climate economist Richard Toll. Toll resigned from a summary group protesting that the IPCC shifted from not without risk but manageable to we're all going to die, from what I think is a relatively accurate assessment of recent developments in literature to the four horsemen of the apocalypse. A recent example of disseminators distorting UN synthesis reports was the portrayal of the latest IPCC report, AR6, as a code red for humanity. The statement by the head of the UN that documented a world supposedly in the midst of climate catastrophe. But the actual report contained nothing whatsoever justifying the endlessly repeated Code Red for Humanity tagline, and in fact contained many statements about the state of climate that were far from being catastrophic. For example, on drought, there is low confidence that human influence has affected trends and meteorological droughts in most regions. On storms, there is low confidence in most reported long-term, multi-decadal to centennial trends in hurricane frequency or intensity-based metrics. On floods, in summary, there is low confidence in the human influence on the changes in high river flows on the global scale. Confidence is in general low in attributing changes in the probability or magnitude of flood events to human influence. The massive distortions of the UN's IPCC synthesis reports by disseminators are due to a combination of the difficulty of dissemination and the motives of disseminators. It is difficult for a science journalist to understand a multi-thousand-page climate report put out by the IPCC, then communicate that understanding, if that journalist believes that their goal is to advance some political cause that will be affected by public perception of what the IPCC report said, then they are virtually guaranteed to distort the report. The IPCC reports are a case study in how what we're told the experts think can be wrong via a chain of distortions, the reports themselves are distorted by omitting the crucial fact that climate-related deaths are plummeting, then the disseminators of the essentials of the report distort the report to make it seem far more negative than it is. As bad as such distortions are, the worst and most damaging distortions in general, and with fossil fuels in particular, are distortions of evaluation. How evaluation can go wrong. Evaluators are the institutions and people who help us evaluate what to do about what disseminators tell us is true about the world. For example, if disseminators tell us that drought, storms, and floods have gotten far worse and will get far worse still, it is the job of evaluators to help us determine what to do in response. Adapt? Pass a carbon tax? Ban fossil fuels? Ban fossil fuels and insist on replacing them with only renewables? Prominent evaluators include the editorial pages of leading disseminators, the New York Times, the Washington Post, many public commentators, and policymakers. One way to spot when a potentially bad evaluation is being put forward is when we are told that we should listen to the scientists and adopt some specific policy. For example, the "listen to the climate scientists" refrain we hear about fossil fuels. The half-truth here is that we should absolutely listen to the factual conclusions of qualified scientists regarding their area of expertise. But those scientists are not qualified to tell us what policies to adopt, because determining what policies to adopt always involves considerations from multiple fields. For example, the best policy regarding fossil fuels cannot be determined just by listening to the climate scientists, because it also depends on the state of energy economics. The "listen to the scientists" refrain is almost always used to get us to accept a given policy evaluation without critical thinking. And this is what we must never do. We must recognize that going from factual conclusions to evaluations of what policies to pass always involves some method of evaluation, and we must think critically about the method of evaluation used to arrive at a certain policy. There are two major ways in which our knowledge system's method of evaluation can go wrong, often catastrophically wrong, which we must be constantly vigilant for. One, using an anti-human standard of evaluation, and two, failing to consider the full context. An evaluator's standard of evaluation is the standard or metric by which they evaluate a given phenomenon or policy as good or bad. Standards of evaluation can be pro-human. For example, I use the standard of advancing human flourishing, but also anti-human. For example, the elevation of a particular race or class at the expense of the rest of humanity. A common cause of some of the worst, most destructive policies ever attributed to the experts is to take some factual conclusion of researchers and then, after applying an anti-human standard of evaluation, to infer from it an anti-human policy that doesn't follow from the facts at all. Consider the historical example of the widespread conclusion among genetic experts that intelligence has some genetic component. In the early 20th century in the US, mainstream evaluators used the conclusion that intelligence has some genetic component to justify policies of forced sterilization of those judged to be less intelligent. Similar conclusions about genetic intelligence or other forms of genetic fitness were used to justify genocide around the world, including the Holocaust. Today, most of us regard forced sterilization, let alone genocide, as horrific, and I believe rightly so. The fact that someone does not have a very high IQ does not mean that they have no right to have children, which for many of us is an essential life goal. But in the early 20th century, the prevailing standard of much of the mainstream knowledge system was, in effect, maximizing intelligence and other desirable genetic attributes at the expense of individual lives and rights. By this anti-human standard, forced sterilization was totally justified. because the issue of standard of evaluation is so consequential, and anti-human standards can be so destructive, we must always try to be aware of what standard or standards an expert policy evaluation is based on, and be perpetually on the lookout for anti-human standards. This is particularly the case if we're told, as with the moral case for eliminating fossil fuels, that the experts advocate radically restricting or even banning some major aspect of life as we know it. Sometimes it can be hard to identify when an anti-human standard is at work in a given expert policy evaluation without an in-depth exploration of the arguments for that evaluation and the people making it. For example, I believe that the moral case for eliminating fossil fuels is a deeply anti-human argument, but I can't prove that to you until we examine it in depth throughout this book. However, I can point to aspects of the moral case for eliminating fossil fuels that, even without deep examination, are cause for suspicion that an anti-human standard is at least partially at work. One cause for suspicion is the insistence not just on rapidly eliminating fossil fuels, but on replacing them with exclusively green or renewable energy. These two terms refer primarily to intermittent solar and wind energy, always excluding nuclear energy and usually excluding large-scale hydroelectric energy, even though nuclear and hydro are the world's two largest sources of non-carbon energy. A pro-human approach to reducing or eliminating CO2 emissions would eagerly embrace all forms of cost-effective non-carbon energy so as to produce as much non-carbon energy as possible, not limit itself to green or renewable energy, especially when it is already advocating eliminating 80% of our global energy in a world that needs much more energy. A second cause for suspicion that an anti-human standard is at work in expert calls for fossil fuel elimination is the use of the term climate change, meaning man-made climate change, as an unequivocal negative. From a human flourishing perspective, climate change is not inherently bad. And climate change that involves more warming and more CO2, plant food, in the atmosphere will surely have many positives, even if they are significantly outweighed by negatives. On a human flourishing standard, we want to avoid not climate change, but climate danger. And we want to increase climate livability by adapting to and mastering climate, not simply refrain from impacting climate. Besides using an anti-human standard of evaluation, the other way knowledge systems can go very wrong in the realm of evaluation is by making policy evaluations that fail to consider the full context of relevant factors. Many harmful policies are the product of ignoring factors that have crucial effects on human life. For example, various government responses to COVID-19 failed to consider the full context in two ways. Initially, certain governments did little and/or told citizens to change nothing about their lives, failing to take seriously the new context of a novel coronavirus that was extremely dangerous for certain portions of the population. Other governments only took COVID-19 seriously, imposing prolonged lockdowns that sought to reduce the danger of COVID-19 to citizens' lives, but did not factor in the dangers of lockdown measures to citizens' lives, such as deaths due to lack of screening for cancer and other killers, deaths in mass depression due to prolonged isolation, and permanent damage to children's mental development and therefore prospects in life due to lack of in-person education. By being aware of the dangerous possibility that a knowledge system's evaluations are not considering the full context, and asking of any given evaluation, is this evaluation truly considering the full context? We can protect ourselves against some of the worst policies advocated in the name of the experts. While I have already given numerous indications that the expert moral case for eliminating fossil fuels might involve significant distortions by synthesizers and disseminators, the strongest evidence by far that it could be very wrong, catastrophically wrong, is that it involves an egregious failure to consider the full context. That failure is opposing something on the basis of its side effects without considering its massive benefits. the unique, massive, and desperately needed benefits of fossil fuels. Whenever we are evaluating what to do about a product or technology, in order to consider the full context, we need to carefully consider not only the negative side effects, but also the benefits. For example, when considering an antibiotic or vaccine, we need to weigh their benefits against their side effects. Most of us would consider it disreputable to oppose an antibiotic or vaccine just on the basis of its negative side effects without carefully considering the often massive life or death benefits involved. I submit that our knowledge system is making this very error, opposing something on the basis of its side effects without considering its massive benefits when it comes to fossil fuels. Prior to 2007, the year I started studying energy in depth, I didn't think our knowledge system was ignoring the massive benefits of fossil fuels because I didn't think there were really any significant, let alone massive, benefits of fossil fuels. One reason is that I simply didn't think much about the benefits of energy. I grew up in a liberal area, Chevy Chase, Maryland, and attended mainstream schools, so the benefits of energy were never a subject I was taught about, nor was it a subject that the media talked about. The second reason I didn't think continuing fossil fuel use had significant benefits is that I considered different forms of energy, whether oil, solar, nuclear, or wind, as more or less interchangeable in their benefits. So rapidly eliminating fossil fuels didn't seem like it involved any harm, because alternatives could do everything fossil fuels could do, at the same cost, just without the side effects. But when I started studying energy, I learned three crucial, undeniable facts about the benefits of fossil fuels that hold true to this day, and yet are ignored by our knowledge system when it advocates for the rapid elimination of fossil fuels. These facts are: 1. Fossil fuels are a uniquely cost-effective source of energy. 2. Cost-effective energy is essential to human flourishing. 3. Billions of people are suffering and dying for lack of cost-effective energy.